Today on Off Mic, the world is on high alert for coronavirus. The president is allocating more money to deal with the crisis, and former Indiana governor and U.S. Vice President Mike Pence is leading the government's response. What is being done in Northwest Indiana? We talked to the health commissioner for the city of Gary. Also, it appears that the Republican-controlled Indiana legislature is trying to push out Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill. What's next for the embattled AG? And move over, Chef Nick. We're talking to our own chefs from the Gary Art House Social Kitchen. All this on Off Mic. First, the news. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Michael Puente. Well, seems coronavirus is gripping the world. The U.S. is responding by trying to get more of those test kits into the hospitals. We've seen a number of confirmed cases just across the state line in Chicago. But what's happening in Northwest Indiana? Joining me to talk about the local efforts is Dr. Roland Walker, Health Commissioner for the City of Gary. Dr. Walker, what is your role as Gary's Health Commissioner, as appointed by Mayor Jerome Prince?
Well, as the Health Commissioner of the City of Gary, I direct health policy as it relates to the municipality. So in Lake County, there's three health departments, the East Chicago Health Department, Gary Health Department, and then the Lake County Health Department. So outside of Gary and East Chicago, Lake County has jurisdiction over the rest of the county. But I have jurisdiction over Gary, as well as we also run our own health department. So we do immunizations. We do STD surveillance for a five-county area around Northwest Indiana. We do as much education as we can do possible for, you know, all health-related issues. We do vital records, which is birth certificates, death certificates. We do restaurant surveillance. So it's kind of a catch-all job. And also, any type of policy that relates to government and the hospital, government and outpatient clinics, that sort of thing. So I enjoy what I do.
Great, great. And how long have you been in practice?
Oh, wow. I have been practicing pediatrics. I graduated from a pediatric residency in, what year was that? 2004. And then after that, I did an advanced standing in a family practice residency. And then I finished that in 2000.
And are you originally from Gary?
Born and reared in Gary, grew up on 5th and Taft, right down the street from the hospital. Outside of college and medical school and residency, been here my whole life.
And you always wanted to be a doctor. Did the hospital play a role in that? Did you often visit when you were a kid?
You know, it's funny. I tell people that as the hospital, you know, evolves and goes through changes, I've seen different CEOs, I've seen different doctors come and go. And, you know, often sometimes I'll come across somebody I haven't met before, and I have a doctor ask me, are you a new doctor here? And I'll laugh, and I was like, you know, I've been at this hospital, particularly North Lake, but South Lake too. I've been here my entire life. So I used to do some volunteer when I was a child, particularly in high school. Did some volunteering and did some classwork when I was in college, in medical school, in my residency at University of Illinois, and then the residency at Methodist for my second residency. So I've been here basically affiliated my entire life. I was born in the hospital. I've been admitted there several times. My child was born in the hospital. My wife was born and practices in this hospital. So, you know, I've been part of the fabric of Methodist Hospital and Gary my entire life.
That's amazing. Thank you. Well, obviously, everyone right now is talking about coronavirus. And we know right now Indiana hasn't really had an official person diagnosed with coronavirus. What are you telling people in the city of Gary how to prepare, how to, you know, deal with this? Is it something that you're actually dealing with in the city of Gary?
Well, I want to start off with an anecdote. So somebody told me that they were looking at their Clorox wipes, and then the bottle was the wipes come in a little conical box, plastic box, and they said they saw on the back of it that it kills coronavirus, and the dispenser was 2 years old, and they said, well, how is it that we knew 2 years ago that this virus was coming? And that goes to show that people, it's a common, coronavirus is a group of viruses that have been around, you know, forever. And this is a mutation. We're not exactly sure where it came from. So COVID-19 is just one mutation of the coronavirus, but there are multiple. And so, you know, it's similar to, like, every year they say the flu virus changes a little bit, and so that's why we get different flu vaccinations every year. Same thing with coronavirus. So in this case, the widely held hypothesis is that this could have been one of the coronaviruses that was passes from animal to animal. And sometimes, occasionally, you'll get a mutation where the virus can be passed from an animal to a human, and then you can have human-to-human transmission of that new mutation. So we believe that happened in China. And then, of course, as we're spreading around the world, this is where we are now. So, you know, the people ask me, well, are we going to see it in Northwest Indiana? And the answer is absolutely yes. It's going to come. You know, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. We sit right in the Chicagoland area, and Chicago has a large international airport. It's a center for people that vacation. It's an international travel destination. And so we're part of Chicagoland area, so we're going to see cases at some point. Then the question is, you know, how will it spread? Will we be able to track it? And we don't know the answers to any of those things. But what we do know is there's a large amount of people with this virus that are asymptomatic. So with the COVID-19, they may have it and either not show any symptoms or show mild symptoms, because it can be no more than a common cold for some people. And so that's why we ask for people, if you don't know and you have symptoms, we're asking people not to go to large areas, not to go to school, not to go to work, not to use rapid transit if you think that you have something. But that would be the same recommendation we would make, you know, for flu outbreaks or any outbreaks. If you have respiratory symptoms, you shouldn't go to work. But, you know, like I know, in America, everybody's afraid to call off. And so people go into work sick all the time. You're sitting at work and you're saying, man, that person's coughing or sneezing. And, you know, there's a chance to spread that way. So, you know, we're trying to avoid large meetings, public events, if we have respiratory symptoms.
Right. And us in the press, you know, we report when that first case hits in Northwest Indiana, the press is going to be all over it. And we want to inform people, but we don't want to overly scare people. We don't want to scare people at all. So what is your recommendation if people hear when Northwest Indiana or Indiana gets its first case? Not to freak out, first of all.
Well, so when you asked me in the beginning, what does my job entail? I guess one of the first things I should have said was to inform the public without causing panic. And like anything else, I've been trying to figure out how to make that happen. So the things that I want to inform people is that this virus is spread by close contact. And we define close contact as anywhere within a 6-foot radius. We believe that it's respiratory droplets. So cough, sneeze, if cough, sneeze lands on surfaces, can live on a surface for a period of time. So we ask people to disinfect. Now, it's not going to live on a surface for weeks, but it could be hours or days. And I doubt even with this virus is days. But I can't say with without certainty. So that's why we ask people to disinfect areas. If you're getting, like, if you're getting on a plane, I'd say disinfect the tray in front of you. I mean, it's common sense. So we're asking people to wipe down the doorknobs. We're asking people to wipe down phones. That's another common area. Computer keyboards, computer mouses. We're asking people to wash their hands for at least 20 seconds. So if you sing your ABCs twice, that should get it done. While you're washing your hands. If you don't have soap and water, soap and hot water, we're asking people to use hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Now, the biggest thing is, and every day I'm driving down the street and I see this more and more, is people wearing masks. And the one thing that I think that our Surgeon General, who's actually from Indiana, has done well is educate people that masks may be putting you in more danger because you have to have the right type of mask. So if it's the small little surgical mask that you see, the kind of flimsy ones, kind of paper mask, that's not going to protect you. And I see people wearing them everywhere. That's not going to protect you from getting COVID-19. But however, that being said, if somebody has respiratory symptoms, I might encourage them to wear it so that it would, if you were to cough or sneeze, it might block some of that spreading to other people. The only mask that's protective, there's two types of masks that are protective. The medical grade M95s, and there's also some construction grade M95s that you can get from Home Depot or Menards, and that has not been proven to be effective. They're both respiratory masks, respiratory grade masks, but I would always say to use a medical one. And so those can be used to protect, but one, they're in short supply. Two, you need to be fit tested with those masks. So if you were to go and if you were able to find them online, Amazon or whatever, where the price has gone through the roof, by the way, if you're able to find them, then you still would have been fit tested. So we usually health professionals do that in hospital settings, or they'll have some contractor come in and do a large group and do fit testing. So that's not occurring. People are buying these masks up. Then there's the M99 mask, which is even more expensive. But those are the ones that healthcare professionals should be using to care for people who are suspected to be infected with the COVID-19 virus. Also, people who are infected would probably also be encouraged to wear M95 masks to prevent the spread to other people. Asymptomatic people without the virus, I would not recommend wearing a mask. You actually may put yourself at more risk by wearing other types of masks, simply because it'll make you touch your face more often. And touching your eyes, touching your nose, and touching your mouth would put you at more risk for spreading virus to those membranes to give you disease.
Let me ask you this, doctor. Just recently, I tried to make an appointment to see my own doctor for a bad ankle that I sprained because I fell on some ice about a month ago. And they asked me a series of questions, and I think it was just related to, and I just told them, look, I don't have the coronavirus. That's what you're getting at. But if you suspect that, okay, you might have the flu or you could have coronavirus, what should you do? Should you go to an emergency room or should you go to your clinic or the urgent care? What's the proper, what should you do?
Well, I think based on what we have available now, the first thing I would do is do exactly what you did. I would call ahead and tell them I have respiratory symptoms. Because your healthcare professional make their decision currently, that's the recommendation right now. And that's fluid. It may change. But wherever you're going, whether it be your primary care physician, an emergency room, whatever, call ahead because you don't want somebody waiting in the waiting room with respiratory symptoms. They need to be immediately brought in and put in isolation somewhere so they don't spread it to everybody else. The largest chance that we have currently of getting tested as it is today on this Thursday and getting people to isolation is probably going to be our emergency rooms because they have the space to put people in isolation and then to get tests. Now, testing has been a real challenge for us. And as you've probably heard now, there's been a sparsity of these test kits. We have been informed as public health officials that by the end of the weekend, now the end of the weekend would mean tomorrow, that the state of Indiana Health Department would be shipped a bunch of test kits and that they would be able to process those at the state health department in Indianapolis. Was previously they were not processing the kits and everything was going to the CDC. And from there, those test kits at Indianapolis State Health Department would trickle towards us the people that would be testing would be like a local health department like mine, would definitely be a hospital like Methodist, which is near me and where I'm on staff. And then maybe some of the doctor's offices would have to purchase their own test kit through some commercial vendor. That being said, there's still this debate about how testing is going to be paid for. But generally, and I've heard this said, and this should be the rule, in a case that is a risk, is an emergency and a potential pandemic, definitely epidemic, that those tests should be free to the general public. And definitely if you're somebody insured, the insurance definitely going to pay for it. And if you're on Medicaid, Medicare, definitely going to pay for it. But even uninsured at this point should be free to them. There are some horror stories. There's a gentleman that came back from China. He was in Florida. And he wanted to do the right thing. He felt it was symptomatic. He went to the doctor. Through the grace of God, somehow this doctor was able to get a test kit and tested them. And the gentleman tested negative. The gentleman got a $3,000 bill. So we don't want that to discourage people from getting tested. So definitely under Obamacare, I use that term loosely, it's the Affordable Care Act, all these testings were deemed free in this emergency setting. There has been some rollback during the Trump administration of some of those free testing, but we believe that still that these tests will end up being free. But that's fluid.
Let me ask you this. Are there any test kits right now in the city of Gary at Methodist Hospital to test for coronavirus?
I can speak directly to the health department. The health department currently does not have any tests. I can speak directly to my private office. I don't have any. I do not know that Methodist, I can't speak for them. I do not know that they have any test kits. So you'd have to reach out to them for that. If in my case, as health commissioner, if I deemed that somebody needs to be tested at the hospital, I would reach out directly to the state health department. I'm in constant contact with them. And then I would make sure that the test kit was. So if I felt it was a public safety issue, I could get a test kit to Methodist very quickly. But do they have any on hand? I honestly just don't know. That would be something they'd have to share.
And we don't know what the situation is as far as test kits at various hospitals in Northwest Indiana.
No. So one of the things I have done is I reached out to the people that I have authority. So I reached out to Methodist Hospital. I reached out to our three long-term care facility nursing homes. I reached out to the police department, the fire department, and asked for their plan. So all these organizations would already have a respiratory droplet spread infection disease control plan. The fire department and the police department were the very first people that already get on top of it and have their plans ready. I've already received two of the plans for two of the three nursing homes, and I'm awaiting the third already. So that happened very fast. Methodist Hospital's emergency preparedness team has been working closely with Gary's emergency preparedness team. So we've gotten a lot of cooperation from them in the last couple of days. I know that our mayor has spoken directly with the leadership in the hospital, and the coordination has been very good since that point. I also know that I have had a lot of contact with the head of infectious disease at Methodist Hospital, Dr. Slulion, and he's worked with me. And anything I've asked, he's immediately been able to help me with. So people are really trying. I don't think there's anybody can tell you that we're expert. I'm not an expert in this. It's my job to become an expert because this is so new. And also, I think my job is to be prepared for whatever decisions are made on high to come to us. So, for instance, when I first became health commissioner, this is the second time I've been health commissioner. When I first became health commissioner back in 2009, that is right at the time when H1N1 was becoming a big deal. So I kind of had an idea of what kind of direction they were going to move in this time, except at that time they had developed a vaccine pretty quickly, and so we were vaccinating. A vaccination for corona, COVID-19, is going to – that's a minimum a year down the road, probably 18 months down the road, and that's fast-tracking it. So I think what we're going to have here in our emergency response is going to be probably a lot of testing, guidelines on isolation, and a ton of education. And education changes. We do better when we know better. So,
right. Well, Doctor, I could tell you this right now. In just speaking with you during this interview, your demeanor is such that it's calmed me down a little bit. you've got that way in your voice of just okay, don't panic, you've got a calmness to your voice. So thank you very much on that. So
I appreciate that.
Well, Dr. Walker,
you know what? I've got to tell you, we've been here before.
Yeah.
And so remember? I mean, and I'm sure way before me, my time, but we've been here with H1N1, we've been here with Ebola. So this is my plug for making sure that government funds emergency preparedness. Whenever I hear public health being defunded, so all that money goes into, you know, when we don't do that, then we don't have stockpiles. We don't have teams prepared. And you know, when you see that money going into other things, and so we can save that money, and then you see that money going to some general fund, and then somebody gets something, you know, totally different. And then when these emergencies come, everybody goes, oh, God, what are we going to do? So we have to always stay prepared. So that's my skill for public health.
Well, Dr. Roland Walker, Health Commissioner for the City of Gary, thank you so much for speaking with me. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time out to speak about this important issue.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
Hey, Paisano, travel with Let's Eat as we visit with Albino's Pasta Shop out of Valparaiso. Let's break bread and sip a little Chianti with owner, operator, and chef, Nick Albino. Albino's Pasta Shop creates all their pastas in-house, like lasagna, spaghetti, rotini, tortellini, raviolis, and don't forget those huge meatballs. Call in 769-9577 and check out the freshest Italian food in the region. Ask Albino's Pasta Shop how they make that tasty pasta and win a gift card from Albino's Pasta Shop out of Valparaiso. Tune in Friday at 3 o'clock on Let's Eat with Sharon Jackson and me, Chef Nick, for an hour of Appetanza on 89.1 FM, Lakeshore Public Radio, WLPR. Call in and join the fun.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Well, this weekend at the Art House Social Kitchen in Gary is hosting an event called Meet the Chefs. It's a brunch and social event. Joining me to talk about the event is LaShawn Brooks, director of Art House, and Chef Tasha Tanay of Innovative Catering. Thank you for both of you for being here Off Mic.
Thank you.
So, LaShawn, tell me a little bit. Tell me, first of all, for those who may be unfamiliar with Art House, what is Art House?
Art House is a social kitchen that was created in a community downtown Gary, right at 411 East 5th Avenue across from the Railcat Stadium. And the Art House is a concept for the community to come together just as well as a shared space, a kitchen, an incubator, we like to call it. Where those small businesses that are looking for an opportunity to grow their business or either start their business utilizing the kitchen. And that kitchen has four spaces where chefs can be in there at the same time. Also, the facility is an opportunity for any artist that is looking for, from book signing to a CD release, poetry, painting, art, all of those things that could take place at the facility just as well.
Yeah, we should mention, too, and not as a plug for, well, he's not running for president anymore, but it was actually funded by a grant through Bloomberg Philanthropies. And I know Mr. Bloomberg actually visited Gary about a year ago. To Mike Bloomberg promoted it in Gary. So very, very great thing. So Chef Tasha Tanay, tell us a little bit about your experience at the Art House.
I've been affiliated with Art House since about 2015, where I did homegrown foods, which was part of Place Lab and Art House. And we did it originally when Art House had not actually come together as far as like the whole building. And we did that at a art studio. And then I went on to do the Culinary Incubator program twice, because I just loved it so much. And then I met Chef Lamar there. And so I'm a renter of the kitchen. So I've been affiliated with them for about 5 years.
Yeah, you know, a lot of success stories have come out of Art House. I know there's a group that does their own sort of lemonade that comes out of there. Yeah, love tea. Right, right. And very great tea. And I've been to events at Art House, and it's always...
it's top notch. It's top scale. Yes. So, Tasha, tell us, what is your specialty? What do you like to make?
Well, I specialize in Southern Cajun Creole and healthy alternatives. So I also can do vegan and vegetarian as well, and sugar-free.
Wow. And if you had to make your number one dish where people say, you know, when Tasha makes this, I am there, what is it?
Probably my gumbo. I'm known for that. Everybody knows my gumbo.
So, LaShawn, tell us a little bit about this weekend's event. It's on Sunday. It's a way for the community to come out and socialize and see what's being offered, correct?
Right. So the team and I, we got together, brainstorm what we could do to do a re-soft opening and share, because a lot of people don't know, not only about the Art House, but those chefs that are hubbed at the Art House. So we said, let's get together and start this monthly brunch to take place. So it is an opportunity because a lot of programming, and I'm sure Chef Tasha can talk about a youth program that she spearheads where teaching youth how to cook. So it's several programs that we want to birth out this year. And this brunch would assist us with generating that buzz around that. So you in for a treat Sunday, because I don't know how Chef Tasha can limit it down to one. I couldn't possibly say what would be a specialty from one of the chefs, because all of them have some dynamic creations that they are doing. And I guess I'm just mesmerized because it's all homemade food. So, and a lot of people don't get that all the time. And so we want to showcase their skills. We want to have a up close and personal where you can have conversations with them, ask questions, and get to know the chefs and a little bit of some of their secrets for their ingredients.
You say you're not sure how you can boil it down to one thing on the menu, but I'm sure when you go Sunday, you're thinking, I hope they have this on the menu, because if they don't, I'm not going to criticize, but I'm going to be a little disappointed. What's that one dish?
Well, for Chef Tasha, I am very excited. She knows I'm waiting for her homemade biscuits.
Ooh.
Yes, I am waiting for those on Sunday, and some of her delicious treats, the sweet treats that she has. And she has a red bean and rice. Mm. So when it comes to Chef Tasha, those are some of the things that I'm excited to have on my plate Sunday.
Well, Chef Tasha, Shasha, a lot of people are talking about, you know, eating her healthy and going vegan. When you have those type of dishes, when you prepare those dishes, does it take away from anything? Or do you have, say, even like carnivores like me eat something that's kind of made like for vegans? Maybe I could be surprised and say, this is pretty good.
Okay, great question. So being from Louisiana, one of the things I do, the reason I created Jurian Cooks is because I used to be an educator full-time. Now what I do is I educate people through cooking and through healthy eating. So the purpose of the class is to change people's perspective, because a lot of people have that perspective that, oh, eating healthy cannot be good, but it can. It's just about changing the flavors, changing salt, maybe not using table salt, but using pink Himalayan salt or using kosher salt, or just changing that profile, like using garlic and healthy, you know, like using herbs. Versus using, fresh,
mm-hmm.
just things like that. So we often just need to change our mindset because we haven't tried things. And once you change your mindset, you can broaden your horizons.
Well, let me ask you this. I'm Mexican-American. Usually when I hear people say, well, other Latinos saying, well, we got to eat healthy, that usually signs to me that, well, then I can't eat my tamales anymore. I can't eat my, you know, all the great ethnic things I want because it's taken away. I'm sure in the African-American community, there are dishes that people might be pulling back on saying, well, I want to eat healthy, but I don't want to give up my gumbo. I don't want to give up other things that I like. Are you saying that maybe you don't have to give it up? It's just different ways of preparing it.
Definitely, like greens. I know in the African-American community, greens is one of the big things. And what I do with greens is maybe changing the meat on that, going to smoked turkey versus the pork, or even taking the meat element out of that and not having meat and trying it that way. Or even versus frying your chicken, doing an oven fried chicken, and it tastes the same way and it's healthy. Or they have air fryers now, baking versus frying. I mean, there's so many different ways to prepare your food now that is a healthier option. It's just, like I said, trying it and see what works for you. Just adding different ingredients, maybe doing wheat flour or rice flour versus your regular white flour. Adding maybe kale into certain things, spinach into certain things, certain greens, eating more greens, doing quinoa or couscous versus rice. There's different ways to do it. So you just have to be open. And I think always say to my students, try and see what it's like versus just saying, I don't like it. Because I say, if you're not allergic and it's not going to kill you, you should try it because life is too short.
You know, too, I mean, it's imperative that we do it because it's about health. It's about living longer, living healthier, having a healthier lifestyle. And sometimes we've got to, like, turn away from those things that we think we love but may be bad for us.
Definitely.
So. And you talk about there's a youth program to try to get more youth involved in cooking. I know growing up, I was always happy just to learn how to make scrambled eggs because I love scrambled eggs so much. But these kids nowadays, they're getting very creative. They're seeing Food Network. They want to get involved. So how's been your experience in dealing with youth and getting them to cook?
It's been awesome. One of the reasons I created this program is because being a former educator myself, I saw that one of the things kids weren't doing is, like, with breakfast, the school program has totally changed as far as the eating program. And they were eating, like, hot chips and different things like that. And we're having a big problem with childhood obesity. So I said, well, whereas I would get up as a child and cook my own breakfast, we're not doing that. So I said, well, what if the kids know how to cook their own breakfast, something simple and easy? Then maybe they would do it. And then, you know, I saw that food deserts were a big problem in a lot of areas. And I know me growing up in the South, my grandmother taught me how to garden and different things like that. And I said, well, what if they knew how to garden? Then maybe they'll grow their own produce and different things like that. So I said, well, this is something we need to do. And with them taking out home economics in a lot of the schools, all these enrichments, I said, well, okay, let's bring it to them. So let's start a partnership with some schools and bring these programs to the area youth. So we've had an abundant amount of attendance with the program to the point that we have to expand it.
Wow. Well, LaShawn, tell me a little bit, just real quickly, Sunday's event, when and where, what time?
Yeah, Sunday, again, at Art House Social Kitchen, located at 411 East 5th Avenue. And adults, we are asking, there is a price for adults just as well as children.
All right. Okay.
But we are asked all proceeds to help with our programming that's there. So, again, you in for a treat with four of our chefs. They will have four stations of their own, just as well as a buffet and other treats that they will have. We also have some live entertainment that's going to join us, and that is also some of Garyites coming together and allowing the opportunity for the community to really enjoy the Art House.
Well, great. Well, LaShawn Brooks is the executive director of the Art House Social Kitchen in Gary, and Chef Tasha Tanay of Innovative Catering, thank you so much for being here on Off Mic.
Thank you so much for having me.
Appreciate it.
We'll be back with more Off Mic.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Some things you don't really have to question. If you want to believe the dog in that viral video was cooking spaghetti, you go for it. But how your decisions this November will affect your community, that is worth really thinking about. On your NPR station, you get reporting that informs your decisions and challenges what you think you know. Because some things are worth that extra mental energy. 2020 election, it's time to listen.
Listen every day, right here to Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Earlier this week, Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill received some good news. A federal lawsuit filed by four women who accused Hill of sexual harassment was dismissed. But the judge in the case admonished Hill for his behavior in March 2018 during a party at a crowded Indianapolis bar. That's the incident that landed Hill in trouble in the first place. The Indiana Supreme Court is now deciding whether to suspend Hill's law license for 60 days without automatic reinstatement. That could effectively end his tenure as attorney general. And now even Hill's own Republican colleagues in the state house are looking to make things even more difficult for him. The House approved a measure this week that would prevent any attorney general from serving with a law license that is suspended for 30 days or more, and that person could not seek re-election. And Republican Governor Eric Holcomb is supporting that bill. So is this a sort of backdoor way of getting rid of Hill? Joining me to talk about this issue is Andrew Downs, director of the Mike Downs Center for Politics at Purdue University in Fort Wayne. Andrew, how are you seeing this bill?
I think there are two ways to look at it. One is a recognition of sort of the tradition of the courts, some would argue, in the state of Indiana. The courts have always respected the legislative role, or predominantly expected the legislative role, of the legislature, and would often send things back to the legislature and say, this is a legislative matter, now you fix it. They may say this is unconstitutional, but it's legislative, you fix it. It could be argued that given what the code says right now, it's possible that the Supreme Court in its decision would say, there's a problem here, legislature, you figure out what it means. Because it's unclear right now what happens if a sitting attorney general has his or her law license suspended. So that's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is to recognize that by doing this, yeah, sure, they're bringing clarity, but they are by default removing Curtis Hill from office and removing him from office for at least 5 years, which means no chance to run for re-election this year or in 2024. This is somebody who was the top vote getter in 2016 and has shown that he still has quite a bit of support throughout the state. So it's a little hard to guess what would happen at the convention and beyond, but it clearly is curtailing his trajectory as an elected officer.
Why? I mean, but considering some of the allegations against him and the hearing he went through with the Indiana Supreme Court disciplinary hearing, I get that he's the top vote getter. Some of the allegations are troubling. Why doesn't the Republican-controlled state house just remove him from office?
That's an excellent question, and several people are saying that you should have just done that. Impeachment is an option. If you believe his behavior was so objectionable that you support this clarification of the law that by default removes him from office, then why not go through the impeachment process? There are others who say that going through the impeachment process may have actually resulted in him being exonerated and emboldened to do the same, if not more. And they didn't want to risk that. This is a cleaner, safer way if the end game is to try and remove him from office, provided that this can get through. And we should point out that this is an amendment to a bill. It's an amendment that passed 84-9, so, you know, very, very solid majority there. But the Senate will now have to consider the amendment and decide whether they concur. If they do not concur, then it has to go to a conference committee. There is no doubt, though, the fact that Curtis Hill was the top vote getter, statewide vote getter in 2016, has played into what the elected officials are willing to do and say about this. This is somebody who has a strong party base, and upsetting that party base can be detrimental to the party in general or to individual candidates this is something that every candidate will be able to say, while this might affect Curtis Hill, it simply clarifies what the law said or should have said. And by the way, we're not the ones who suspended his license. That was done by the Supreme Court.
You know, Curtis Hill has been at the White House several times. Seems like he's known to President Trump. Is it surprising that President Trump hasn't tweeted out some type of support for Curtis Hill?
You know, the president certainly tweets an awful lot, and I think this is one of those cases where you would almost expect him to. But we should also keep in mind that we're talking about the attorney general from Indiana, which is not the most populous state or the largest state around. It could be that this is one of those times when the president will simply wait until everything has run its course and then tweet about it. And obviously, if the suspension is less than 30 days or there is no suspension of his license and or this legislation does not pass, then in some respects, no reason to do anything about it. It is certainly, if there is a suspension or if he loses his place in the office right now, Curtis Hill loses his place in the office right now, it'll be interesting to see what the president does if he comes here to campaign. Because there's no doubt at this point he would like to have Curtis Hill on the stage with him.
But do you think this is a fight that Republicans want to have in Indiana, or they just would rather just try to avoid?
I think they would like to avoid it. And the way they're going about this, instead of an open impeachment case, give them the opportunity to simply say, we're doing what we're guessing the Supreme Court would have asked us to do. We're providing clarity on what it means for an attorney general to have a license suspended and providing clarity from here going forward. In fact, one of the backers of the bill was quoted in the news as saying this is about attorneys general today and in the future. So this is clarification. It's not just about Curtis Hill. It's about Indiana, and it's about clarifying what needs to happen when an attorney general's license is suspended.
Do you also think maybe Republicans are also just trying to like, hey, look, by the time the Supreme Court decides this, it could be right around the time we're going to caucus on this in June or pass it. And we need to know if we're going to have somebody in line to be the attorney general, at least a candidate from the Republican Party.
The Republican Party obviously has to be taking a number of things into consideration right now. If the Indiana Supreme Court has not made its decision by the time the Republicans are at their state convention, it's possible that whoever else wants to be the Republican nominee can use this against Curtis Hill and say, this is a problem, this is somebody who should not be getting the nomination because we don't know that person's status right now. But it's also possible that the Republican Party is saying, let's just clear this up before we get to the convention. If Curtis Hill is suspended or not suspended, we will know what we need to do at the convention regardless.
Andy, let me just ask you this, kind of a little bit off topic. Why are the attorney general candidates in Indiana selected through a convention instead of like through a primary process?
Yeah, there's some people who actually would like to see us move to a primary for a number of those offices. I think there are at least two things that should be thought about, though. One of them is that when you think about running in a primary, you are talking about running a statewide election, and that would add expense to some offices that do have some difficulty in raising money. For example, the Secretary of State, an incredibly important office, not on the ballot this year, but an incredibly important office, yet I would guess that most people don't know what the Secretary of State does. Same for State Treasurer, State Auditor, and, for example, the Attorney General. This way, it's party insiders who are nominating their candidate to move forward. So it's a party function, the same way the primary elections are nothing more than a party function that happens to be run by elected offices or by public offices. The party is taking control of that particular process and making sure it's their candidate who's out there, not somebody who might be chosen by voters who sort of go rogue and cross over and vote in the primary that's not theirs.
Andrew Downs is the director of the Mike Downs Center for Politics in Fort Wayne at the Purdue University in Fort Wayne. It's actually named after his father. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
Hey,
Hey, Paisano, travel with Let's Eat as we visit with Albino's Pasta Shop out of Valparaiso. Let's break bread and sip a little Chianti with owner, operator, and chef, Nick Albino. Albino's Pasta Shop creates all their pastas in-house, like lasagna, spaghetti, rotini, tortellini, raviolis, and don't forget those huge meatballs. Call in 769-9577 and check out the freshest Italian food in the region. Ask Albino's Pasta Shop how they make that tasty pasta and win a gift card from Albino's Pasta Shop out of Valparaiso. Tune in Friday at 3 o'clock on Let's Eat with Sharon Jackson and me, Chef Nick, for an hour of Appetanza on 89.1 FM, Lakeshore Public Radio, WLPR. Call in and join the fun.
Some things you don't really have to question. If you want to believe the dog in that viral video was cooking spaghetti, you go for it. But how your decisions this November will affect your community, that is worth really thinking about. On your NPR station, you get reporting that informs your decisions and challenges what you think you know. Because some things are worth that extra mental energy. 2020 election, it's time to listen.
Listen every day, right here to Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Michael Puente. We are just a few weeks away for the start of the new baseball season for both the Sox and the Cubs. The teams are putting their pieces in place, including the White Sox. And joining us to talk about the latest is veteran Chicago sports journalist Cheryl Ray Stout. Hey, Cheryl, how are you?
I'm doing well, Michael. And yourself?
I'm doing great. And welcome back again to Off Mic. We love having you on.
I love being on.
Well, okay, so the White Sox, they just made a big announcement that they're trying to sign Johan Moncada to an extension, long-term contract. How significant is this?
Well, it's actually official now. We just got the word from the White Sox. They signed him to a 5-year, $70 million contract. This is significant. It's tying up another piece of their foundation for the future. So for Johan Moncada and all these young players like Aaron Bummer, who they just signed, and, of course, Eloy Jimenez last year, and this year Luis Robert, we're talking about a team that is targeting their young players, getting them locked up for many years so that they keep the window open instead of closing too soon and then have to worry about big agents, big free agent dealings with them. So smart move on Rick Hahn's part, smart move on Johan Moncada to take it. And so now, you know, you go into the season with these players who performed well last year and were showing their promise. Now they're getting paid for it, and now they can relax because it is a way to relax just a tad.
Yeah, Moncada had a year last year that it seemed like he should have been part of the All-Star team. I know the team was doing okay, but you know he didn't make it. But this year it looks like it could be potentially a breakout year for him.
Here's what's interesting, Michael. When you think about it, who did everybody want to be the third baseman last year before going into the season?
Moncada.
No.
Who?
Remember somebody from San Diego that signed with San Diego?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forget his name now. The guy everybody wanted.
Exactly. And so what the White Sox did, because they didn't get that signing done, they put Johan Moncada. They moved him from second to third base. And he performed better there because it's a reactionary type of place to play in the field. So he was relaxed at the plate. He was fifth, you know, in the batting average in baseball. And so he performed well. And so for them to be able to get him settled down, he played well. And the arrow was going up. Remember, he was part of the Chris Sale deal. And, you know, and this is something that the White Sox were hoping would happen, and it did happen.
Right. So, and now the Cubs, you know, I think the Cubs and the Sox actually play today down in spring training. So it's always great to see the two teams playing. But the Cubs, it seems like, you know, they made headlines last weekend and just, you know, they mic'd up Chris Bryant and Rizzo during one of their preseason games. And people just seem to just love it. So the Cubs have a new manager, but they seem to be gearing up for what still could potentially be a run at the playoffs.
Well, if they keep Chris Bryant, that would be the reason why they would be in the playoff hunt. because if they decide, if things aren't going well, he'll definitely be dealt during the season. So right now, with having Chris Bryant also leading off and having Anthony Rizzo batting second, you know, that they think that their lineup is going to be good. They've gotten really good play at the plate from Albert Amor. We talked about that last week. But Ian Happ has also played well. So they're competing for that center field job. Their pitching is going to be matter most. In fact, today, when Lucas Giolito of the White Sox faces John Lester of the Cubs, that's an interesting matchup right there. Lucas hasn't been able to pitch because of a chest injury. And John Lester had a bad performance and a good performance. So how well John Lester goes, Yu Darvish, who was in the hospital because he thought, you know, he had a bad flu, was concerned it was in coronavirus, how he performs. So if their veterans come through on the mound, they should be better. But you just never know because their division is tougher. The Reds, they fed up on free agents, and they also had this nucleus last year that's, you know, a pretty good team. You know, the Brewers, there's teams in that division that have a lot of flaws. So the Cubs really have to have some really improvement from last year. And one of the guys that has to come out well from the spring is Kyle Hendricks. And he always has a slow spring, and then he comes on. So there's a lot of question marks. But it's a veteran team. It's not a young team anymore. And so when we talk about the White Sox window being wide open, the Cubs window is creeping further down.
So talking about veteran teams, there's still a lot of fans out there for the Chicago Blackhawks, and they're looking like they're pushing their way into the playoffs. How are they looking lately? They've been having a little win streak there.
They have. They've won four in a row. Corey Crawford now is the starting goalie since they traded Robin Leonard to the Las Vegas Golden Knights. And so he's in that position. He's played very well. Some of the players that have been just not playing well for months, like Dylan Strome, is all of a sudden coming on. They have the rookie of the year, Dominik Kubalek. He's really, what a sharpshooter he is. And you have those veterans. You have the Patrick Kane, who scored his 30th goal last night. You have the Jonathan Toews. You have these solid core players, but these young players are going through the paces. They're 4 points out of a playoff spot. It's still not easy. They only have a couple weeks left, really, of the season, so they have to make hay. And the fact that they were out of the United Center almost all of last month, they only had three home games last month. This month, they have most of their schedule is at home. So if they could perform well at home, maybe they could creep into their playoff spot and finally get into the playoffs where they haven't been in the few years.
All right. And let's not forget about the Chicago Bulls. They're having a down season, but they got some players back, and they still have that tremendous rookie, Coby White, who still is just lighting up the place.
He's coming to his own. He's comfortable with what he's doing. I've chatted with him a number of times, and I think the thing is he had to get past that wall, that rookie wall, because collegiate players only play X amount of games, and you double it. It's 1.5 times more games once you get into the pros and the travel and everything like that. And I like the fact he's coming off the bench. Some people don't, you know, they think he should be starting, but I think you want a rookie to be comfortable, and then the next step, putting him in the starting rotation. And the issue for the Bulls, too, is that they have all these injured players coming back, and they're on minutes limits. So you've got Lauri Markkanen back, you've got Wendell Carter back, you've got Otto Porter Jr. back, and the problem is you can't play them the normal minutes you normally would, you know, maybe 30, 35 minutes. They're down to maybe 17 to 20 minutes because of their injuries and coming back. So you're not really seeing the full force of what they can do. And with Coby, you don't want to really change the plan of action that you have for him.
All right. And there's been a lot of talk about coronavirus. Is there any discussion or threat that this could impact sporting events as we're moving forward here?
Well, in Europe, they are not allowing fans in most of the soccer venues. Here, I was actually in the locker room. The Bulls were given an email saying that they don't want them shaking hands with fans. If you're going to do anything, do a fist bump. And baseball, they're asking the players not to try to stay away from the fans the way they normally would.
That's pretty amazing. All right,
and
Cheryl, we got to cut it off there because we're running out of time. But thank
one more
you
thing.
So much.
Manny Machado was the third baseman.
Manny Machado. There you go. We both forgot him. So I'd like to thank Cheryl Ray Stout and all my guests today here on Off Mic. I'd like to thank my producers, Dee Dotson, Jose Rodriguez, and the always grumpy Tommy Maloney. Just kidding. So thank you for listening. Have a great weekend. Stay healthy and safe, and wash those hands.